introducing someone that, I don't know what to say. There's no words that can describe it, actually. I'm not allowed to say anything good, so I guess I can say some bad things. Although I don't know any, because this is the first time that I've actually met Mary Pearl, and what a wonderful experience has been so far. When I went home last night, I thought, what will I need for the rest of today and the rest of this weekend? And first thing that came to my mind was bail money. We've been having some fun, and we've been cutting up a lot, and I think that we just kind of hit it off, and I am so, so grateful for this opportunity. And I was scared to death to meet her at the airport and have my little sign shaking. And she said, they're not going to eat you alive. It's okay. And I said, okay. But it is my honor and privilege to introduce to you Mary Pearl from North Little Rock, Arkansas.
Morning. I'm Mary Pearl. I'm an Al-Anon who's happy, joyous, and free. And I'd like to thank the committee for having me back. I was here at the first Marietta Roundup. You know, some of you still had enough courage to come again. And I want to thank you so much for giving Christine to me for the weekend. She is a joy. She is an absolute joy. If you don't know this lady, you need to get to know her. I would also like to welcome the newest member of Al-Anon to our fellowship, Mickey. Stand up, Mickey. She was telling people last night she was the Al-Anon speaker. I hope you will be attending meetings soon. We have a principle called honesty. Y'all get to hear her in the morning, and she is a lovely member of AA. But we would love to have her in Al-Anon. She would fit in my home group because we're pretty crazy. It's always a privilege to be asked to share on behalf of my recovery in Al-Anon. Now, you know, I'm only speaking from my side of the story here, so I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I'm not going to be telling my husband's story. That's one of the things I think is real important, because when I got here, I didn't have a story. You know, it was whatever he did made me do what I did. You know, that was my thing, because I've always been a victim, don't you know? How many of y'all going to believe that? I'm teased often by my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. They tell me I'm a six-pack short. I tried real hard to get in that other program. I really did for a long time. I just don't have an allergy to alcohol. But other than that, everything else seems to be in place, you know. So what can I say? I'm a low-bottom Al-Anon. We are asked to share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, what my life is like today. And there's no way to go from where I came from to where I am today. There's only one power that could have done that, and that's the grace of God. And I'm the youngest of four children, and I'm a change of life baby, which means that everybody else was grown when I came along. And my oldest brother was dead when I was born. The next brother was married when I was four, and my sister was married when I was seven. So I was an only child. I was the kind of kid, you know, my mother's, the people my mom and dad hung out with were people their age. So they didn't have any children. So I was raised with adults. And I didn't know how to interact with children, but I knew what to do in order to get what I wanted from adults. And my daddy was my hero. My mother was the warden. I never liked my mother very much. You know, she always said no to me. And when she'd say no to me, I hated the word no. And I'd go to my daddy and I'd say, Daddy, Mama said no. And he'd say, well, hey, that's all right. We'll do it. And I liked that. I really liked that, you know. My daddy had retired from the Army, where he had been an officer for almost 38 years. And he said he was going to fish and hunt, and we raised bird dogs. And I loved it. I was a tomboy. I was raised on a highway where there were 11 boys and one other girl. And so you became a boy to survive. That was the only way. And I didn't have any problem with that because I was sort of a pushy kid to start with. You know, I wasn't one of those little shy, wanting to wear dresses and bows in my hair, what my mama wanted. And the first thing I'd find is a mud puddle to roll in. I'm like a dog, you know. Get your dog all clean, everything. He goes out and finds something dead to roll in. Well, you know, that's the way I was. And I learned a lot from my daddy on those fishing trips and on those hunting things. I learned a lot because he would listen to me and he would answer all my questions. And I've always been a why person. If I can figure out why, then I can figure out how to head you off at the pass. You know, it's that information, you know. Al-Anons, by nature, seem to be gatherers of information that we can't do jack with once we got. But we got the information. You know, I have that insatiable need to know why. And anyway, I was about 5 years old, and Daddy and I went on a fishing trip. And Mama decided to ruin it, and she came with us. See, my mama doesn't know how to have fun. She, with her, everything's a job because my mother's self-esteem was based on her performance and her job. And if you're not working, you're not worth anything. So Mama made everything a job. And her job was to catch the first fish, the biggest fish, and the most fish. Other than that, you can fish. Well, right off the bat, I screwed up. I caught a little bitty fish. Mama took one look at it and said, it's not a keeper. She ripped it off my hook and threw it back in. Well, I went into a screaming coma right there in the boat. If it's got eyes and a tail, by God, string it, you know. And Daddy said, honey, come back into the back end of the boat with me. And as I got close to him, he said, we'll get her. I didn't know what it meant, but intuitively I knew I was going to like it. And what it meant was every time she'd catch a fish, she'd swing around, he'd take it off, rebait her hook, she'd swing around, start fishing, he'd give me the fish, and I'd throw it over. Every fish the old heifer caught, I threw over. Now, when I was doing a four-step inventory, I wrote that down as one of my most pleasant childhood memories. That tells you a little about me. You know, there was no way in the world that my daddy realized what I perceived from that particular incident that day. What I learned was, if anybody hurts you, do it back to them as many times as you can. Now, I don't think any parent would go out and try to teach a child revenge. But, you know, the really pitiful part of that is I was still doing that in my 30s. Because that was something that I learned early on, got down, and I really love slow premeditated revenge. I still think about it. In November the 30th of 1954, my mother screamed in the middle of the night, call an ambulance, something's wrong with your daddy. And I called an ambulance and I ran in and watched my daddy die of a heart attack. And my world as I knew it ended right there. Because now I'm left with someone that I don't like and I don't understand and I can't please. And I also knew something deep within me, and that was that I had been told a lie. You see, I went to church, and they told me that God loved me, and I knew that that was a lie. Because if God loved me, he would have taken her and left my daddy for me. And so I turned my back on any kind of spiritual belief system or anything at the age of 12. Now, this is going to be fun. You know, because now self-will is really going to take over. And it was sort of like, you know, we declared war on each other. Whoever dies first, the other one wins. And, you know, I'm the kind of kid that will push you and push you and push you. Because, you see, I wanted my mother's love. And I didn't seem to have it. And what it amounted to is, for so long, I tried to get her approval. And I'm really grateful that she didn't give approval because I would have mistaken it for love. And there's a big difference between loving someone and approving of something. And so, like I say, it was not happy in our home. I did everything I could on purpose to irritate and aggravate her. Now, this was sort of stupid on my part because my mother didn't know how to deal with her anger. And so she became very physically abusive to me. And knowing the consequences of that, I would push her. Because at least when she was beating the hell out of me, I had her undivided attention. That's pretty sick. That's pretty sick. In the late 50s, they built an Air Force base in Little Rock. And they had an item in the paper that said there were 10 men for every woman in the Little Rock area. And I said, I want my 10. And I want your 10 and your 10. Because there's never too much of a good thing. Feels good, do it till you die on the spot. Those are some of my principles, you know. So I went trolling. And I found this little old Yankee boy, and he never knew what hit him, you know. And he asked me to marry him. He says, I'll take you away from home. And you see, I wanted to go away from home more than anything in the world. I wanted to get away from her. And back in those days, women didn't leave home unless you were going away to college. A mother wouldn't let me go out of town to college because she didn't want to be alone. And or you got married. And so, therefore, I got married. Well, he took me further than I ever asked to go. You know, the Air Force had all these signs. You could see them everywhere for years. It says, you know, travel the world. See France and Germany and Spain. And we went to Newfoundland. It's a little island off the coast of Canada. I had to get an atlas down to figure out where it was we were going. Never heard of it, you know. And I got there, and I know why you never heard of it, you know. I mean, it was called semi-remote. Well, God forbid you should ever go remote. We had snow 9 months of the year that would have been hip deep on a giraffe. I'm telling you. Now, my drug of choice is adrenaline because I like excitement. If I don't have some, I create some. It's just that simple. It's hard when you just got snow. I mean, you know, you look out in the backyard and there's a moose in the backyard. Well, whoopee, whoopee. And I looked out, and there were little strings stretched across the ground out there, or rather the snow out there in the backyard. And I said, what are those little strings? Well, when the thaw came, those were my clotheslines. You were stepping over them in the meantime, you know. And it was just a strange. And, of course, you know, I'm from Arkansas, and I've never seen that much snow. It's sort of like being here. You know, you get snow occasionally. You know, I mean, we've even had a foot of snow before in my lifetime in Arkansas a couple of times. But, I mean, our annual snowfall in Newfoundland was 190 inches a year. That's average, you know. So one thing about it is it's boring. You can just watch so many snowflakes fall. Where I found excitement and fun was in the clubs, for God's sake. You know, you heard laughter. And so I began to associate. Now, see, Mama had said to me, don't drink. We carry the bad seed. Well, Mama said that because her father died of wet brain from alcoholism. Her mother died of cirrhosis of the liver from alcoholism. Her oldest brother was shot in bed with another man's wife. He was drunk at the time, but my favorite. She had another brother and sister still drinking. My mother was the only non-drinking person in her family. She needed one. She was so neurotic and uptight, I mean. And so, therefore, I got double thrill out of being drinking there, you know. And I like to say, when you would hear that ice go in the glass and then that... when you pour something over it where the ice sort of cracks and what have you. I associated that with laughter, fun, and having good times. And so daily drinking became a way of life for me. And I loved the clubs. Now, my husband played in the band in the clubs. He was the lead guitar picker. But while he was playing in the band, I trolled the room. I had lots of fun. I had too much fun. I ruined my marriage having fun. And I worked for the American Red Cross. I was assistant field director for the American Red Cross there on the base. Now, if you have a need of an emergency leave back in those days, I guess it's still the same way. You had to have Red Cross verification before you could get an emergency leave. And so it was sort of nice because it's sort of a position of power. You know everybody. And like I say, I'm always one of those that likes to push the envelope. I had a black market on the flight line. I was bootlegging watermelons for $10 a piece back in 1962. We didn't have anything up there. It's an island. Everything's brought in. And I'd get hungry for stuff from here. And I would tell one of the pilots, and they'd go down in one of the tankers down to the States, and they'd pick up stuff for me and bring it back. And, you know, that was good money in that. They also had a law about liquor. that you weren't allowed to take liquor off of the base because it's unbonded liquor. So that means you get it real cheap. You could get a gallon of VO for $5. Yeah, isn't that wonderful? I still have one of those bottles. I save pennies in it. It'll hold $72 worth of pennies. Anyway, so I knew all these guys, and so it came, you know, we extended, and they were going to close the base, and then we were talking about where we were going to go. And I was talking to the guy down in SAC assignment section, and I said, where are we supposed to go? And he said, well, y'all are being transferred to Minot, North Dakota. Minot? I'm not. I'm sick and tired of this darn snow stuff. I do not want to be in the snow anymore. He said, where do you want to go? I said, well, I want to go back to Little Rock. Don't you know it's going to be all different back there now? You've been away for 5 years. It's going to be different. The only problem is wherever I go, there I am. And I didn't know that. And so now I don't remember ever discussing this with my husband because it wasn't really important what he wanted. And so I told the guy, and I said, well, get us back to Little Rock. He said, there's not an opening in your husband's career field. I said, well, make one. And he said, well, I can't. And I said, well, then change his career field. He said, oh, I can do that. So with a stroke of a pen, my husband, who was an aircraft mechanic, overnight became the head of a missile inspection team. He'd never seen a missile. Y'all make you sleep good tonight, don't you think? So we got back to Little Rock, and you know something, things were different now, but it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. That's my thing always. When you get what you think it'll take to make you happy, it's never what you thought it was going to be. And so then you always have something over there. It never occurred to me to be content with where I was. And so we were going to try it one more time since our marriage wasn't working well. And I don't know about y'all, but that trying it one more time stuff, you know, we're not little kids playing jacks. You don't get to throw overs. Because the thing of it is, you don't have anything any more than you did when you started here, you know. And so guess what? It didn't work one more time. And I decided then that I needed to be separated because something had happened while I was out of the country. Hippies had happened here in the U.S. And I wanted my opportunity to be a hippie. And I needed to be a free spirit. And as I told my husband, I need to find myself. Well, now, that was not a lie. I was lost, but not the way I thought. And so what it amounted to was I wanted to be separated. Now, my husband came from a broken home, and he did not want to be divorced for anything. And so I told him, well, let's be separated, because I really didn't want to be divorced either because I wasn't ready to be self-supporting through my own contributions. I may be sick, but I'm not stupid, people. And so he went on to his next base assignment, and I stayed there, and now I'm free. I don't have mama to tell me what to do. I don't have anybody else. I can do anything I want to anytime I want to, and I don't know what to do because I'm a reactor. You do something, I react to it. If I don't have somebody to react to, what do? You know, so I'm looking around, always looking outside of me to feel what's wrong on the inside of me. And I discovered across the street from me was one of them. Now, see, my mother's family, when they drank, they were mean people. And they would hurt one another, and they would shoot one another and set it fire to a room on your house or stuff like that. You know, they were always entertaining as hell. And this boy, he would come in drinking, and he would beat his wife up. And so I knew he was one of them. And she was a little French-Canadian girl, and she didn't speak very much English, and so we became friends, and she was pregnant. And he went out and got drunk, and he came back in, beat her up, and she went into labor. And so she came back over to my house, and she said, I'm in labor. She said, would you take me to the hospital? And I said, yes, I'll be glad to. And I'm looking at her, and her lip is busted, and her eyes turning blue. And it really just got all over me. And I went into the house, and there he was. And he was passed out on their bed with a smirk on his face. And I thought, yeah, boy, somebody ought to whip your butt. And then it occurred to me, I'm somebody. So I took a slat out of the bed, I wrapped him up in a sheet, tied him up, and I took that slat and beat the fool out of him. Made me feel good all over, you know. And how was I to know this was a preview of coming attractions? The next morning he came over to the house, asked if I knew where Joanne was. I said, she's at the hospital. He said, well, I was in a hell of a fight last night. I said, I guess you were. On the other side of me was another one. Did you ever feel you were a carrier? Because everywhere you go, there they are, you know. And the doctors had told Freeman if he were to continue to drink, he would die. So Freeman quit drinking. As far as I know, he never found Alcoholics Anonymous or any treatment for his alcoholism, and he died within a short period of time, a very miserable man. But now I get to see what irritable, restless, and discontent is real close, you know. Now, I'm a night person by nature, and so I have fun because I'm out entertaining myself. And so I get home around 7 in the morning, and he's got a garden, and he wants to till his garden at 8 o'clock. Well, this is stupid because this is going to keep me awake. You know, it's all about me, you know, to hell with everybody else, you know. So I go out and tell him about it, and he tells me to shut my mouth and get my fat butt back in the house. See, he doesn't know about Mama and the fish. So I get my daddy's frog-gigging headlight, and I mow grass at 11:30 at night. Well, the sheriff come to see me. Have you ever noticed how the law enforcement people are narrow-minded about things? So I go into Plan B, because every good Al-Anon has a contingency plan, you know? And so this was, he had these 6 beagle dogs. Now, if you've got 1 beagle dog, you know what a barking little dog they are. With 6, you got a chorus. So I'd wait till the wee hours in the morning. I'd jump off my back porch. I'd run across the yard, go over to his dog yard fence with a broom handle, run up and down that dog yard fence, get those dogs in a frenzy. I'd run, jump back on my porch. He'd come staggering out of the house. He's screaming and cussing at the dogs, hosing them down. He's out there in his underwear just, you know, having a horrible time. And then he'd go back in the house, everything get quiet for about an hour, and we'd do it one more time. Well, the sheriff came to see me. And there were several more plans along that same line. And then one day it occurred to me, we better do something different. We're beginning to develop a relationship now with the sheriff, you know. So that's when I noticed we had a neighborhood softball team. It was a mixed team, all ages, just fun neighborhood back in the 60s. And so I got me some stretch boots and hot pants and joined the team, you know. I love, you know, I was an athlete in school. I love this, you know. So I'm out there, and it was our custom after the game to go back to somebody's house, and we'd discuss the game and what we could have, should have, and our strategy for our next game and what have you. And at that time, some of them were popping tops, and some of them were sniffing stuff, and some of them had these little sugar cubes, just your normal neighborhood. And it was my time to have them all over at my house, and there just it happened this young boy, he was 18 years old on our team, he got drunk at my house. And I knew if he got picked up going home by the sheriff, then I was going to be in major problems now. And I didn't want to go in for contributing to the delinquency of a minor. And so I drove him, and some of them followed me to bring me back. And I noticed in his pickup he had this China tea set on the front seat. And I said, what's that? He said, that's for my mom for Mama's Day. How sweet. And so I thought, well, if he tries to carry that in the house and he's as drunk and staggery, well, he's liable to break that, so I'll carry that for him because, you know, we are ever helpful. And so here's the picture. It's 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm going in a house I've never been in before in my life, escorting a drunken 18-year-old kid, and I'm carrying a tiny China tea set, your everyday situation. And he went in his bedroom, and he flipped the light on, and there's a man laying on the bed and in his underwear, and he looks up, and he says, hot damn, little brother, you brought us a broad home. I said, not tonight, fella. But that's who I'm married to. Yeah. People ask you how you met. I say, in bed. Later on that summer, I had a birthday party. It lasted 3 days. Like I told you, I love excitement. Party, party. And he came over. His brother told him, said, you ought to go on. Mary's having this great big party over there. And he was there for about 15 minutes. He determined I was too weird. Too weird. Now, how could you see? I had this long black hair, sort of like, you remember how Cher used to wear it, you know, parted down the middle, long black hair. And I had mowed my grass and threw it in the house. And had these cushions around, you know, just sort of hippie-ish, you know. And the walls were painted black, and we had this white lights, and it was, you know, just a normal house. And he thought I was weird, you know. Well, later on that summer, though, I we got together again, and all of a sudden we determined that we had a lot of things that we liked in common, and we got to talking, and we were easy to talk to, and he had just been divorced for about 6 months to a year from a girl that he has a childhood sweetheart, and they were in Arizona. And so JD and I started dating, and for the next 4 years we had a wonderful time. Now there were two or three instances in there where I realized that he didn't know how to drink well, because he didn't seem to know when to quit drinking. You know, when he would come to pick you up sober, I didn't like him so much. But after a couple of drinks, then he wasn't so uptight. You know, he's a little more fun. I just didn't have him very long because he'd just keep on drinking, and it was like his personality would change, and it was like having a whole harem for an evening, you know. You had so many different personalities, you know. And he would get to thinking about every bad thing that ever happened to his life. You know, this is not good. You know, and then he'd get a mouth on him like an old Chevy trunk lid. You couldn't keep it shut, you know. And then I'd have to put him out of my misery. And 4 years we went on, and then he ruined it. He asked me to marry him. Because, you see, there's a time to tell things, and if you pass the right time to tell things, sometimes that right time never comes again. And I had failed to mention to him that I said, I can't marry you. And he said, well, why not? And I said, well, I'm already married. I forgot to mention that. And he said, you're married? You sure don't act married. I said, I forgot. And I said, well, how did you think that I lived here and I had this nice house and I had a new car and I don't work? How did you think? He said, I thought you was rich. Sorry. Well, I filed for divorce, got the divorce, and alcoholism moved into my home. JD, I got divorced on Monday. JD and I got married on Friday. And I never had a clue, because, you see, it didn't look like with the alcoholism that I had seen with all of my grandparents there. It just didn't look the same. And you know, you have that idea how it is in your mind. And so my grandfather was the under the bridge wino, what most people used to think alcoholics were. So now fun begins. You know, JD would tell me he was going out for a short cup of coffee and be gone a week. You know, how does that happen? How do you just disappear? I know now it's an allergy, and he broke out in spots. New Orleans, Memphis, Dallas. You know, he would travel, you know, and he would forget where he lived, that kind of thing. And I would call all the friends. I would call his parents. I would call the jails and all the hospitals. And the fear set in. And that's where my obsession to make him quit drinking started, because I couldn't deal with the fear. So the way to cure that is to keep him home. And so then we go into what we've all done, those things, you know. We played hide and seek. He'd hide and I'd seek him. You know, he would go to some places that normally I wouldn't be caught dead in. That's the reason he'd go there, because he didn't want me to find him. And I'd go in and he'd be with some lower companion over there having a good time. That's not going to happen. And so I would go tearing across the room, turn the table upside down, slap her flat, throw a drink in his face, and proceed to pulverize him. The bouncer would throw me out. I don't know what you're griping about the bamboo lounge or whatever. I have been barred from 3 bars and 2 pawn shops, and I'm not drinking. I'm drunk on emotion. I'll give you that. Okay, things go on, and then finally I determined that I couldn't live like that anymore, because there were so many trips to the jail, and he would beg them at the jail, don't call her, don't call her. She'll hurt me, don't call her. They'd call me. Because, you see, that way they didn't have to have any police brutality charges. Because when they would pick him up, he would have to tell them all about their parentage and what have you. You know, he'd get that big mouth on him when he... And he's a little guy to have a big mouth, you know. But anyway, I got to the point where I told him, I said, I can't live like this any longer. I just can't live like this any longer. I had gone back to work, of course, and I was working a lot of overtime because I didn't want to come home anymore. You know, those things that we do, you think we'll go to work to supplement the income that's going out, and then all you do is turn around and pay it for fees and car repairs and hit and runs and all like this. And so anyway, he said, well, I think I'm sick. And I said, boy, that's the truth. You are sick, sick, sick. Now, you know, in our book, it tells us that sarcasm means to tear flesh, you know. And I broke a man's spirit with my sarcasm and with my mouth because I kept telling him how low down he was, how dirty he was, how nothing he was. And if you hear that consistently over and over and over, it does something to you when you already feel bad about yourself on the inside. And so anyway, but when he said he was sick, I said, okay, I'll fix him. I'll take him to the doctor. And now the doctor knows what's wrong with me. I've been going to the doctor for years. I've got high blood pressure. I have a lot of stress. I've got this. I've got that. And he would say to me, is everything all right in your job? Yes, everything is wonderful in my job. And he'd say, how about at home? Fine. My home is fine. You know. Because we're ashamed because, you know, deep down somewhere I always felt there was something wrong with me or he wouldn't drink because he used to tell me that. Who wouldn't drink if they were married to a bitch like you? Who wouldn't drink? You know, and I knew what I did, so therefore it must be. And there's another thing, too. When you accept unacceptable behavior, there's a reason you do that. And, you know, with all his womanizing when he was drinking, I realized later, after being in the program, why I accepted that unacceptable behavior. It's because I had been the one unfaithful in my first marriage, and I felt like I deserved that kind of treatment. And so, therefore, I wouldn't force the issue on any of that. Well, anyway, the doctor had told him, he said, Alcoholics Anonymous is the people that help have more success with alcoholism. And J.D. says, I'm not an alcoholic. And I said, that's right, he's not. You know, he's a drunk, but he is not an alcoholic, you know. That's what my grandparents were. And so he says, but I've got some friends who are taking a drug called Anabuse. Can I have a prescription? And, you know, I know today that crows don't fly with doves. His friends were taking Anabuse for a reason. But anyway, so he left there, and I have the prescription because he cannot be trusted. He lies all the time. And so I go get the pills, and I become the keeper of the pills. Now, what I heard the doctor say was, if you give him a pill, he can't drink. That is not what the doctor said. You see, I'm into my sickness that I hear what I want to hear and I see what I want to see. I don't hear what I don't want to hear and I don't see what I don't want to see. And so I became the keeper of the pills. And every morning in the hurry, I've got high blood pressure, I've got an epileptic dog, and JD's on the pill. So in a hurry in the mornings, I can't guarantee who got what, but everybody got a pill. And now we have the year of the dry drunk. And you see, this is really confusing because I knew that the problem was his drinking. And he quit drinking. And my life is still horrible. How can that be? How can that be? Well, it must be him. It wasn't the drinking. It was him. And I am so miserable. And so that summer, the committee came and moved in. And it was just a day like any other day. But all of a sudden, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking. And when I hear somebody I sponsor say, I've just been thinking, that's so scary. So, because I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, you know, I am so miserable. God, isn't that the truth? Well, why don't you get a divorce? Well, we can't get a divorce. What do you mean we can't get a divorce? Well, you've already divorced one. If you have to keep divorcing people, what's the common denominator here? We're not going there. But, you know, if you could be a widow, what? If you could be a widow, if he were dying, you could be a widow, and that would be, oh, I like that. But he doesn't seem to be dying. We can take care of that. Well, what do you want to do? Well, I think, let's stab him in the neck with an ice pick and watch him drip. Oh, God, that is so good. Well, or we could back over him with the car, squish him up in the tread, make a note, buy new tires. I began to feel better. There was light at the end of the tunnel. And then there was a lady that had killed her husband, said he was an alcoholic, and they put her in prison. That would never have happened if I had been on that jury. Never. And so now I've got to have another meeting. And so later that fall, like I say, all Mary Pearls are sitting there, and we're talking about the situation, and all of a sudden, you know, it was, well, you know, if an alcoholic were to pass out in the bathtub and drowned, who would know? We all liked it. It was a group conscience. you know, once you've got the solution, you know that takes the pressure off. So you just wait, because sooner or later, you know, there's going to be an opportunity, you know. And sure enough, you know, a year to the week that he went on the interviews, J.D. got drunk. And it's like, how can that happen? You know, I guess I thought when I gave him that pill on his tongue every morning that it was like an aspirin that would go and just dissolve. And it never occurred to me he was spitting them out, you know. And he says he wasn't consciously planning the drunk, but when he didn't need those pills anymore. And he said now today he knows he was planning that drunk. But anyway, there was ice and snow on the ground at home, and I had come home from work early that day, and I'd noticed there people in Arkansas, probably just like here, don't have drive on ice and snow, and it's really just like a zoo out there, demolition derby, you know. And I came home, and then later I heard our truck coming in. It sounded like it was in second gear doing about 60. That sound, you know. And when he came, he hit the hitching post horse, which was cast iron, at the end of the driveway, plunked that off, went sideways across the yard, hit a tree, and then bounced into the side of the house. And I thought, my God, he can't drive on ice and snow, you know. And I'm looking out that front window at him, and he opened that truck door, and he poured out. And I'd seen that too many times, and I said, I'll kill that SOB if it's the last thing I ever do. So when he opened the door, I never said anything to him. That was very unusual, because normally I had a lot to say to him. And I just hit him. And I hit him as hard as I could. And see, being raised with them boys, I don't fight like a girl. I don't scratch and pull hair. I hit. So anyway, he fell, and when he fell, he hit the coffee table and knocked him out. And I drug him across the living room floor, down the hall, into the bathroom, ran the bathtub full of warm water, took his clothes off him, put him in the bathtub, and held him under. I held him under until the bubbles quit coming, because I wanted him dead. He was the problem. And another voice that was not a committee member came in, and it says, look what you're doing. You can't do this. And I picked him up by the hair of the head and said, the hell I can't. And I put him back down again. And I'm standing there, and the voice came back and says, do you not realize you're committing murder? You're taking the life of someone you once loved. And it's a moment of clarity in which you see yourself as you become, and I had become an animal to fight an illness. And it scared me to death. I thought, oh, my God. And so I jerked him out of that bathtub. And thank God I had worked for the Red Cross. You see, God always goes ahead and plans in love. He knows what you're going to need. And I knew how to resuscitate him. And I resuscitated him, and I took him in the bedroom, drug him in there, and I dried him off and put him in bed and got the hair dryer and dried his hair because I didn't want him to catch cold. Well, you just don't understand. You don't want a sick man. A dead one's okay, but sick, they're such babies, for God's sake. And then I closed the door on that room, and I went in the living room, and I began to rock in my chair for the next 8, 10 or so hours with a desperation I had never known in my life, because, you see, I knew I couldn't live like that anymore. But I didn't know how not to live like that anymore. No more light. And J.D., I heard him. I didn't go back in that room for 3 days. And I heard him scream. I heard him beg for help. I had heard him hallucinate. I had heard him do stuff for years. It never occurred to me that he was in any kind of trouble. But J.D. had alcoholic poisoning. He nearly died in that room. He hemorrhaged in there. And it's only by the grace of God that he's alive today and I'm not in jail somewhere. That is the grace of God. And so I went on and I went to work because, see, I had my two best friends to help me, justification and rationalization. How do you live with yourself once you do something like that? Well, if he hadn't got drunk, I wouldn't have had to do it. It's not my fault. You know, you do that blaming. The only problem with blame is if you take me out, all you got left is blah, blah, blah. You know, was my fault. And so I came home from work one day, and he was sitting at our bar, and he was shaking. And he said, would you call Alcoholics Anonymous for me? I've been trying to call all day long, and I keep getting the wrong number. And so I called Alcoholics Anonymous Central Office, and a lady answered, and Her name was Mary Peeler. She was a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Arkansas. She's been dead for years now. But Mary told me there was a meeting in 1 hour's time at a community building 7 blocks away from our home. That building was built by my grandfather, who died of alcoholism. And so I took J.D. that night to his first meeting, and I was in such good shape that they rushed him into Al-Anon and me into AA. That's sort of pitiful when you think about it. You know, of course, I got him straightened out real quick. There's nothing wrong with me, you know. It's him with a problem. And there was I loved old-fashioned AA. There was a man that came over to him, looked worse than Grandpa did when we buried him. And he said, "Boy, I'm going to be your sponsor." You know, it wasn't wait around till, you know, you can find somebody you can relate to. J.D. would have died if he had had to do that. And God knew that, and Durwood came over, and that old man saved my husband's life. And he was an old retired railroad man, and he would take him around to all the different places and introduced him to all the AA community in the county so that there would be a meeting and a place for him to go, and he knew where there would be people. And J.D. was so sick that he couldn't work. And so Durwood says, "Why don't you go to the Serenity House and learn all about your disease?" So J.D. Went to the Serenity House. And, you know, there's nothing worse than somebody getting better in the family and it's not you. That's hard, you know, because, see, I come in and I'm trying to talk to him and he'll say, "Easy does it." He said, "Honey, you got to learn to live and let live." And that crap he's out with. I can't handle that. And then J.D., he worked maybe once or twice a week for 10 years because the boss said when J.D.'s here, he works better than 5 men. And that's the reason they keep him on. But now he couldn't work. And so J.D. got fired. Now, this is what got me to go to Al-Anon. You see, the thing that was threatened now were my things, my material possessions. And how was I going to do the whole deal without that little bit that he had been contributing, you know? How was I going to make it? And I was afraid I was going to lose my material things because those were my signs of success. And so I went to Al-Anon. Well, every time he'd go to an AA meeting, the Al-Anon women would send back a pamphlet by way of him to me, and I wouldn't read that trash, you know. But I didn't throw it away. And one night, he was real late coming back from the meeting. He and his sponsor had gone on a 12-step call, and I didn't know, and I was scared. And so I called that number, and there was a girl had put a little card in there, said, "My name's Earlene, if you ever want to talk." "It's 11:30. I want to talk, Earlene." And she was very, very nice. I got her out of bed, but she talked to me, and she said, "We're over here if you ever want to come." And I said, "Well, if I ever get bad, I will." And when he got fired, it got bad. And so I called, and there was a meeting the next night, and so I went over there to that meeting. And I went in there, and I was dressed like the Queen of Sheba, you know, and I'm very successful, you know. I just wanted them to know that. I just need a couple of things. And A, how do you keep an alcoholic sober? And B, how do you manage when there's nothing left to manage? And there was a real smart aleck visiting there, and she said, "C, we don't know." And I wept. I just wept. I said, "How could you not know? I've come to y'all." And they said, "Well, we understand." Now, you know, those are the most comforting words to a newcomer, is that somebody understands. For the first time, you're with people who understand. And then this one began to share her experience, strength, and thought by telling me about her story. I was hooked. I was hooked. And, you know, the thing about it is I would continue, and I look back at it years later, and I say, why did I keep going back? Because I wasn't doing anything. I was just listening. I was just going and listening. I wasn't making any changes, no visible changes. Why did I go? Because I felt loved for an hour. I felt that there was some sanity in my life for an hour in an otherwise insane world I was living in. And I kept going. And if you keep going back long enough, it's not important why you come, it's why you stay. And then I began to see and relate, and I wanted what they had. And then you get a sponsor, And then the world changes. That's where you make a commitment to your recovery. Get somebody. The step doesn't say, I did. It says, we did. So you do it with somebody else. Because, you know, by yourself, you don't know. And so I got my sponsor, and off I went. And I'm telling you, my journey just went whoo. Because, you see, my sponsor, her solution to every problem I had was the same. Pray about it. Well, I had to tell her about this deal when Daddy died, and that I just couldn't. She said, well, can you say please, and can you say thank you? We'll start with that. And I would ask her to pray for me for things, because I knew she and God were hooked up. I knew God liked her, you know. But my low self-esteem and my own, the thing of it is, when you compromise your own belief system over and over and over, you put God on a human level. And you can't forgive you, so therefore you don't think God can forgive you. But God is not a human. God is God. And God doesn't care what you do. He loves you because he created you. And that he creates, he cannot hate. And I didn't know those things. And so she would pray with me and pray for me and until I could be able to do that. And she'd say, get on your knees by the side of your bed. And I said, I don't like that. And she says, well, put your shoes under the bed. And while you're down there, okay, I can do that, you know. And she would tell me to do the most stupid things. The only thing about it was they worked. And my brilliant mind was not able to do that. You know, you can't think yourself out of a thinking problem. She says when your thinking's broken, don't use it so much. And that makes a lot of sense. And then I was always wondering what you were thinking. And so I'm always thinking what you're thinking so I'll know what to do. And she said, he who walks in another's mind is lost. Because you're never thinking what I'm thinking you're thinking. Because, see, I'm thinking you're thinking about me because I'm so self-centered it never occurs to me you could have a thought other. You know. So I began to do the deal. And then lo and behold, after about a year and a half, I began to realize I had some respect for my husband again. I had taken the focus off of him and what he wasn't doing, and I put it on me, what I wasn't doing, and corrected those things. And then all of a sudden, I realized that I had a real, real nice husband. And he is. He's a sweetie. He has his moments. For God's sake, he's alcoholic. What do you expect? You know. But you see, alcoholism is a family disease. We all have the ism. That I, self, and me, that self-centeredness stuff. Well, I began to work on those things. And then after a period of years, I want to share with you about me and the witch. My mama, you know, I had this deal with my mom, you know, that we couldn't be in the same room together 5 minutes that we were not, you know, just at it, you know, just at one another, this kind of thing. Now, my mother had been a dressmaker, and so I would go over there, and she would make all my clothes. And so I'd come in, and the thing about my mother is she would make my clothes the way she wanted them. I'd bring a pattern material. It wouldn't resemble the pattern because you won't look good in that, so I'll make it this way. And that would irritate me. And we would fuss and fight and all this kind of stuff. And my sponsor said, and I would call my sponsor, and I would be crying and whining. And she says, why do you continue to take the material and everything over there to her if she won't make it the way you want it? Because she does it for free. The thing about it is, mother would never charge me or my sister for clothes. I mean, that was so foreign to her. You know, that's your child. You don't do that. And she says, but if you're not happy with the results, why don't you just go buy something? Well, that made so much sense. You know, and you see, all my life, I'd never thought about that, you know. And that's just like, JD and I would fuss and fight in the morning in the bathroom because he squeezes the toothpaste in the middle of the tube. And I told my sponsor, I said, that drives me crazy. She said, get two tubes. That had never occurred to me. You know why? Because I wanted him to do it right. See, I'd rather be right than happy. You know, that's not the way it is. Today we have two bathrooms, I don't even know what kind of toothpaste he uses, you know. And isn't that great, you know, because, you know, we can both be self-supporting through our own contributions, you know. It was just so many things to learn, to relearn, you know. And so anyway, with mother, she says, we'll pray about that, about the relationship with you and your mother. And she says, and when God is ready. Now, I had tried several times to make an amends to my mother, and it had not gone well. I had been in, let's put it this way, I took J.D., when he was in the Serenity House. I went over there one day and was sitting through some of the classes because I was curious to learn about projection and all the various things that they were talking about, and they were talking about making amends. Worth the step you're on. When you're on step none, the ninth step is not a good place to start. So I go over to my mother's house. See, I've heard all this stuff, you know. And I go over to my mother's and I said, you know, Mama, you said you always felt that I always hated you. You were right. Now, that's not a good way to start an amends. And so I call my sponsor after the disaster, and she said, you did what? You know? And she says, well, you can make an amends for the amends when you get to that step. You know what I mean? And so, like I say, every time I had gone to her, it had been a bad kind of thing. And so my sponsor told me, she said, I think that there's going to be a whole process for you to work through. And, you know, God sent a lady down from Missouri to our group for a year who had had a lot of mother problems. And she was able to share her experience, strength, and hope in what she had done. The first thing she told me is, she says, you know, you're going to have to give up the dream of how you wanted your mother to be. Because your mother is not the person that you wanted her to be, because she can't be the person you wanted her to be. She's the person of her experience, just like you're not the child she wanted either, I'd be willing to bet you. You know, and I've learned there's no such thing as perfect children. There's no such thing as perfect parents. But there is, at some point, you have to be willing to accept the fact that you got to give up all hope of having a better childhood. It's over. You're here now. You know, so quit being a little kid, you know, and quit expecting Mama to be like June Cleaver, you know. I mean, that was not her life experience. And so she says, accept your mother as she is. She says, that's the greatest thing you can do for another person. She says, if a newcomer comes in and they're sick, well, don't you accept them for what they are and love them anyway? Yeah, it's easier with a newcomer. You know, and it is. It is easier to love somebody that you don't know than to have to go back with the wreckage that you have all this thing. And she says, but clearing up the wreckage of the past will do more for you than anything. And so anyway, I began to work on that. And then I was told to act like a loving daughter. Well, what does a loving daughter do? I don't have a clue. Find somebody who has that kind of relationship. Ask them. And so I began to ask around. And I found out that they wanted me to do things that mother wanted. Duh. You know, it was agony to buy a Mother's Day card. They don't make one that says, Happy Mother's Day, bitch. They just don't have one. They've got all these little sweet syrupy cards. I just read them, go, bleh. I can't do that. I got Mama a Maxine card one time, says, the longer you bitch, the longer God lets you live. Well, Mama's in her 80s, you know. I thought, that's funny. Mama didn't think it was funny. So I had to do what I was told to do. I went and found that sweet card that I really didn't want to do. And I had to sign my name on that card, which I really didn't want to do. And send that card to my mama. And I began to do that. And it wasn't an instant thing. But the main tool that I was given was ask God to let you see your mother like he sees her. What does God see when he looks at your mama? You know, God's going to look through eyes of love because God is love. God's not going to look at all of her negatives and condemn her for her negatives. He's going to look at her because he created her and he loves her. And so I prayed that prayer over 4 years. God, let me see my mama like you see her. And then one day in the fall, I went in over at my mom's, and as I drove in the driveway, I saw her. She was out in the back field. She was raking leaves. And I recognized something. She was short. Now, that sounds stupid, doesn't it? She's short. You don't know. She comes up to hear on you. You don't know. No. Because, see, Mama was always formidable. Why is that? Because every time you come as a child. And when you're a child, Mama's big. I came as a child wanting mother to give me something. When did you ever come bringing something to your mom? When did you come? Well, I never did. I was always wanting her approval. I was wanting her love. And I would give her things or do things, but that's not what I'm talking about. It was like I never brought anything into that relationship. It was always a gimme, 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 like a little kid. And I could see that. And as I began to walk back toward my mama, it's like God let me see inside her heart. And it was full of scars and hurts. You see, I always felt like mama had a lot of love that she withheld to punish me. And she didn't have it. And I realized, you know, she came from that alcoholic home. How was she to know what love was? How was she to know? She did the best she could. So I keep on, I'm walking back there, and so I knew if somebody was going to have to bring love into the situation, it was going to have to be Mary Pearl. Because I'd been taught how to love in rooms like this with people like you. And I've been told to pass it on, so I've got to take it home. And so I went to my mama, and I said, Mama, put your leaf broom down for a minute. And when Mama put her leaf broom down, I gave her a hug. And boy, she's stiff as a poker, you know. Because she didn't know how to accept love. But I continued every time I went over there to give her that hug. There's great power in the human touch. That pat. That, you know, just the power. And it began to change me, too. And then one day I went by my mom's and she wanted to know, how come when your daddy died you were such an ornery kid? And I said, because I was getting even with you for not loving me. And she said, what do you mean I didn't love you? I gave you a roof over your head. I gave you clothes to wear. I gave you food to eat. It was more than I ever had. You see, my mother had been physically abused by her father for years. She had scars all over her body where he'd cut her with a knife and done things to her. And then when she was between 12 and 13, he came in drunk and tried to rape her. And she took a stick of stove wood, hit him in the head, and ran away from home. And she walked from Gleason, Tennessee to Memphis hundreds of miles. She slept in culverts. She stole food out of people's gardens. You know, it wasn't fashionable to be a runaway in the early 1900s. She ended up in an alleyway in Memphis where she's living in a box next to a rooming house. And the lady who owned the rooming house was pregnant, and she went out and offered Mama a job for room and board. And my mama was thrilled to get out of that. And she worked there. My daddy was the head of the recruiting office for the Army in Memphis, and he took his meals at that boarding house. And they met, and when she became 16, they got married. Now, if you had had to live like that, what's the greatest gift you could ever give a child? A roof over your head, never to have to worry about what to eat or something to wear. And you see, my mama had given the very best. And see, I just took those things as that's what I'm due. I didn't realize that was a luxury to some people. And you know, that day it became enough. And my mama stood up and I said, Mama, what can I do to make it up to you at this point in time for all the hurt that I've done all these years? So many of it on purpose. I was a rotten daughter. What can I do? She said, forgive me for not being the kind of mama you needed. And I said, Mama, I forgive you. And my mama got up, walked across that room, took me in her arms, held me and told me she loved me. She'd always loved me, and that was the first time I'd ever heard those words. And that hole inside me closed up because I did what you told me to do. I walked that walk, and I learned to be consistent in that behavior. My sister had been the mother I always wanted. My older sister, Dorothy, had no children. She's 16 and a half years older than me. And she was my mom all those years, and I never realized it because, see, I kept looking at Mama to give it to me. She didn't have it. I was getting it from Dorothy but missed it because I was never focused on it. I kept wanting it from over here, you know. God always has what you need there. Sometimes we reject it, you know, and that's what I did. And Dorothy had been my mom all my life, and I was able to thank her for being that mom for me. On November the 30th of 1999, 45 years to the day, my sister died in the front seat of the car with me. And I rushed her to the hospital. She choked twice, threw her head back, and you could see her chest wasn't moving. And she was blue by the time I got her there. And they were able to resuscitate her. And we have Dorothy's body, but I don't have my sister anymore. Her memory is gone. She has no short-term memory, and she's lost the last 25 years. For the last 5 years, the year 2000 was a very difficult year. I lost my sister as I knew her. I found out I had a heart condition. Both of my dogs, 16 and a half years old, died. One of the girls that I sponsored had a pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot in your lung. And she died instantly. And it was just a year of just total grieving and loss all year long. And it was very, very hard. I was able to get my sister out of the nursing home because we got her where she could walk and talk and what have you. But she has to have somebody with her around the clock because she can't remember, and she's diabetic, and she has to take insulin twice a day, and she'll forget to take it or take it two or three times and go into a coma. And so it was necessary to have that. And that was a very expensive proposition, and finally the money ran out, as we knew it would at some point. And on December the 27th, this past December, I had to put my sister in a nursing home for the rest of her life and sell her house and all of her possessions. And that was one of the most difficult things, because we had to do it every day, because Dorothy would say, "Where is my house and where is my stuff?" Because she can't remember, you know. We're going through that right now, you know. And the thing about the program is, you're not bulletproof. Life is going to continue to happen when you're here. But I have not had to walk one step by myself. I've had my sponsor. I've had the people that I sponsor and people all over the world that have been keeping me in prayers, and my sister and J.D. On the 1st of December of this year, we found out J.D. was major diabetic. He had always been able to eat anything he wanted, never gain weight, eat as much as what he wanted. And the doctor, he went for his annual physical, and the doctor called me at home at 8:30 at night and said, "Is Mr. Thompson there?" And I said, "He's asleep." And he said, "Well, get him up and over to my office right this minute. We may have to put him in the hospital." J.D.'s blood sugar was over 600. He said he could have a heart attack, stroke, or go blind at any moment. Well, you know, you're with somebody every day, you're not noticing, you know, but he was losing weight. You know, he'd lost 30 pounds without trying to in a year, and he was just sort of grateful, you know. You know, he just saying, "You know, I don't have to worry about my weight." I said, "Well, I guess you do." And so we're going through that process of the life's change now, you know. So life continues on. But, you know, I had to go back to work in the year 2000, and God made me a place to work. A girl I used to sponsor, she's a grandbaby in sponsorship now as an attorney, and she needed someone in her office, and she called and said, "Would you like to work for me?" I had worked for her 6 weeks a couple of years before when her girl was out sick, and I just did it for fun. And when I found out I was going to have to go back to work, well, there it was. God provided that. And so I am very blessed. I am very, very blessed. So I want to tell you one last thing about my sister. My sister asked me, she says, "You know, if I die in the car with you again, will you promise not to let them revive me?" And I said, "You know, Dorothy, I promise if you die in the car with me again, I'll drive you around 6 or 8 hours till you're stiff as a damn poker." She says, "Well, good." You know. Because she's got enough sense to know that she's in the condition she's in, you know. She knows she can't remember. And it's real, she never knows what day it is. And, you know, it's like Thursday I had her for lunch, and then we went to get her nails done, and the nail girl said, "What'd you have for lunch?" She said, "I don't think I had any." You know, that kind of thing. But, you know, not having a memory is good if all you can remember is the bad stuff, you know. But I tell her, "Dorothy, there were so many good things that we'd got to do for so long." So I'm real grateful that, you know, that God has given me the opportunity to maybe do something for Dorothy, because God knows she was there for me all my life. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors, but he worketh steadily. Oft times in sorrow, sometimes foolish pride, I forget he sees the top while I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttle cease to fly will God unroll the canvas and explain the reasons why. But the dark threads are as needful in the skillful weaver's hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern God has planned. Thank you.